Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up today, as President Barack Obama pulls out the stops on stem cell research on human embryos, we look at alternative research that's less risky and more promising. And did Pope Pius XII close his eyes to the drama of Europe's Jews in World War II? Or did he work behind the scenes to help them? An international study group winds up a seminar in Jerusalem. And in anticipation of Pope Benedict's upcoming visit to the Holy Land this May, we offer a Lenten reflection on the Holy Family's flight into Egypt. United States President Barack Obama signed an executive order Monday lifting a ban on federal funding of embryonic stem cell research that was imposed by former President Bill Clinton in 1995. This ban was relaxed by President George W. Bush in 2001, but still restricted funding for the vast majority of embryonic research. Both presidents allowed funding for research for stem cells from adults, umbilical cords, and placentas. Stem cells can generate cells for different tissues of the human body and might be able to cure several illnesses. The Catholic Church supports stem cell research but objects to any experimentation which destroys human life. Cardinal Justin Regali, the chairman of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops Committee on Pro-Life Activities, called President Obama's executive order on embryonic stem cell research a sad victory of politics over science and ethics. As he signed the executive order Monday, President Obama declared he would end what he called the manipulation or coercion of the scientific community when its findings are inconvenient.
In a way, Obama's coming out with a statement that science is something totally neutral, that there's no sort of problems that we can raise, etc., of an ethical nature to apply to it, can all be looked at just purely from scientific terms. This is the thing I think that's horrifying here. It's not a question of science versus religion. It's about, can you put any controls in place on science? Does science exist in a moral vacuum?
Josephine Quintavalle directs the UK-based public interest group Comment on Reproductive Ethics. Well, Associate Director of the Pro-Life Office for U.S. Catholic Bishops, Richard Doerflinger, says 10 years ago all the hype was about the outstanding results human embryos would bring to stem cell research, but reality has shown otherwise.
What we know now about human embryonic stem cells is that they are much more difficult to work with and to turn into any use in human beings than people originally imagined. They are very prone to growing uncontrollably and causing tumors in laboratory animals. And now the researchers are talking about not one decade, but maybe several decades and maybe never until these cells are actually used in any treatment. In the meantime, other avenues of stem cell research, especially stem cells from adult tissues of various kinds and from umbilical cord blood from newborn babies, have proved to be extremely useful in therapies, and some of those trials have now begun to reverse terrible diseases in human patients in clinical trials, and some of them already are in widespread clinical use for cancers and leukemia and are moving quickly toward treating many other diseases.
In actual fact, embryonic stem cell research is still at the research level. It hasn't delivered any cures to humans at all. Whereas if you look at the alternatives to embryonic stem cell research, which have been with us for a longer period of time anyway, but which are, you know, developing every day, a sort of day in, day out, there's novelties coming through. They can start counting and telling you things like there have been over 20,000 patients treated with stem cells from umbilical cord blood, perfectly legitimate, perfectly acceptable, no ethical problems involved. There are over 80 diseases now being treated with adult stem cells. So adult stem cells are clearly the cells that don't have the ethical problems that the embryonic stem cell has, But also in the meantime, since 2006 to 2009, they've made incredible steps forward, is in creating a stem cell which has the properties of the embryonic stem cell but doesn't rely on killing a human embryo. So in this instance, what they do is they take a cell, you take a skin cell, say, and they've learned a technology, the biologists, to turn that stem cell back to the very early stage of development. So they've turned it back to a cell that has the properties of the embryonic stem cell, but no embryo has been created in the process. Now, one of the wonders of these kind of stem cells is not just that they solve the ethical problem, but they're actually better than the embryonic stem cell. Because if you want to cure yourself, there's nothing better than your own cells to cure you, because you're not going to have any rejection problems. You're not going to have to take immune suppressant drugs for the rest of your life if you have a transplant of your own stem cells. And in 2 to 3 years, these particular kind of stem cells, which are known as iPS cells, induced pluripotent stem cells, they have leapt forward in terms of progress. And it's absolutely so exciting, the potential of these cells. And another point to underline is the economy of the United States. In times of such stress economically, they have to be very careful how they spend money. And I don't think any money should be directed towards a kind of stem cell research that is unethical, unnecessary, and which is showing itself not to be even the right way forward. Just if you're just looking at it from a purely objective, ethics-free science. I think at the moment, our best weapon is to say, it's rubbish science you're talking about. You've just got to stop doing it. You cannot throw money, public money, away on science that's not going anywhere, particularly when your country's going through such a devastating economic crisis. But what's happening is the scientists are holding on to a position which is untenable, I think, that they should be allowed to do anything and there should be no holds in place. And that's what ethics is about, which roads should be open and which should be closed. And I think, you know, this is what President Obama is avoiding by not really looking carefully at the ethical issues here, but also he's not even looking pragmatically at the reality of where science is leading us. So it's one area where science is on our side at the moment. It's just not going to bring the solutions that they're hyping up from the use of human embryos. It's just not going to happen.
The dose of reality is, let us look now at the avenues of stem cell research that are really moving quickly toward treating human disease, and it turns out that they are the avenues that were dismissed as less useful by the embryonic stem cell researchers. They turn out to be the avenues that there's really no moral or ethical problem with as well.
Richard Doerflinger is the Assistant Director of the Pro-Life Office for U.S. Catholic Bishops. And earlier, you heard Josephine Quintavalle, who directs the UK-based public interest group, comment on reproductive ethics. An unprecedented meeting between Jewish and Catholic scholars at Israel's Holocaust Memorial wrapped up in Jerusalem Monday evening. Members of the Studium Theologicum Salesianum in Jerusalem joined a panel from the International Institute for Holocaust Research of Yad Vashem. It was a two-day seminar focusing on the role Pope Pius XII played in World War II. The pontiff, who led the Catholic Church from March 1939 until his death in 1958, has been criticized in some quarters as having done little to defend Europe's Jews from Hitler's ruthless campaign to exterminate them. Yet the Church and some Jewish historians object to the criticism, countering that circumstances forced Pope Pius to assist the Jews secretly out of fear of far-reaching consequences not only for Europe's Jewish communities, but for the Catholic Church as well. Dean of the Studium Theologicum Salesianum, Father Roberto Spataro, helped organize the encounter. He told me the panels included those who were sympathetic to Pius XII's World War II actions and those who weren't. Just getting them together a first time to compare notes made the weekend meeting a success.
So this was the first purpose of the meeting, and the atmosphere of the meeting was so friendly that actually the meeting, at least with this regard, was very successful.
I'm sure you have seen some newspapers in Israel today in which the Israeli side has talked about the results of the weekend meetings. Can you tell me anything about what you read in the newspapers?
I have just read the piece of news given by Jerusalem Post, and I don't know if other newspapers reported anything about it. But just after reading the Jerusalem Post, I can say that they tend to set the news inside the large framework of the relationship between the Holy See, generally the Catholics, and the Jewish world.
Did they have any negative or positive?
No, not negative.
Did the decision to have this study group or have this study session have anything to do with Pope Benedict's upcoming visit to the Holy Land in May?
No, because the meeting was planned before the visit of the Holy Father was announced, and I'm glad to say even before the rumors of the Holy Father's visit were starting spreading. But, of course, any attempt to improve the relationship between the Catholic Church and the Israeli world, Jewish environments, of course, has a good impact on the forthcoming Pope's visit.
Now, members of the Catholic Church have objected to a plaque contained in the Yad Vashem Holocaust Memorial in Jerusalem that suggests that Pius XII did little to prevent or to denounce the Holocaust. Now, I know that Catholic experts at the weekend study session were attempting to present a different side to Pius XII that may not be widely known. What sort of testimony did they present in defense of the pontiff?
Actually, experts, the Catholic experts, but I would like to say the historians that maintain a different position from that Catholic Pius XII attitude and action. So the historians, they introduced, they presented plenty of documents, and in a certain sense, they had the difficulty of choosing what kind of documents to base, to ground their position, because in reality there are so many witnesses that allow us to show the behavior and the attitudes of Pope Pius XII were very supportive of the Jews during the Second World War.
What were some of the reactions of the Jewish scholars? Were they aware of much of this material presented over the weekend, or was it mostly unpublished documentation?
So during the meeting, some unpublished documentation was introduced, and therefore the reaction of the Jewish scholars, the scholars invited by Yad Vashem, was very positive. But mostly the documentation that was commented on was already known by all the historians. But the way of presenting and interpreting them was quite different from what those who criticized the Pius XII do. And in this sense, I found that also the historians invited by Yad Vashem were very attentive and sensitive to the different interpretations.
I noticed that you corrected me there by saying that the scholars invited by Yad Vashem. So
yes.
I understand that not all of them were Jewish scholars. Is
that
right?
Yes, because the scholars who attended the meeting came from different parts of the world. It was a very international meeting, both Europe and America, North America, the States, and Australia. And not all of them were Jews.
I see. Well, it appears that much of the bad press that Pius XII has received over the years came really to the fore only in the 1960s, when a fictitious play denigrating his role in World War II gained worldwide attention. Was any discussion devoted to news coverage or criticism of the Pope during the wartime years and the first two decades after the war?
Yeah, you are very right. It's a very odd situation that after the Second World War until the beginning of the 60s of last century, Pope Pius XII was regarded by all people as a great defender of the Jews, and also some documents that prove this gratitude of the Jews for what he did during the Second World War was mentioned during our meeting. And to be honest, the documents that were brought forward during our meeting to support the criticism of the Pope for what he did or what he did not do after the Second World War was very, very weak.
Now, Jewish scholars and some Holocaust historians have suggested they want to reserve judgment on Pius XII before they are able to examine the Vatican's secret archives for the World War II years. Did that issue come up, and what was said by both sides on that topic?
Yes, all the serious historians are well aware that the opening of archives takes much time. And therefore, also during our meeting, everyone was aware that we have to wait for a while to have access to the so-called secret Vatican archives. But anyway, it was very interesting that some pieces of documentation that was discussed, presented and discussed during the meeting, belongs to archives that so far are not known, not explored by the historians, or that have just been opened. And one of the things that was underlined, emphasized, is just this one, that there is the possibility of going through so many sources in order to widen our knowledge of what happened about Pius XII and widen the spectrum of our consideration.
I think what you're talking about, correct me if I'm wrong,
yes,
a certain number of pre-wartime years of the archives have been opened and have been made available to the public here in the Vatican, and not very many people have actually tried to access those years.
Concerning the Vatican, first of all, the archive until 1939 are available, that's to say, whatever concern the role of Pius XII before being appointed as Pope, that's to say when he was nuncio in Bavaria and then in Germany, and as Secretary of State of Pope Pius XI. There are other private archives that can be examined. And anyway, it is a very recent announcement that has been given by the Vatican official that within 5 years, also, the Vatican archives concerning the Second World War, and that to say the time of Pope Pius XII's pontificate, will be available.
Just to push you a little bit further, Father, on these private archives you're talking about, we heard recently that a convent, for example, here in Rome, released some very important documents back to 1943 that showed that the Pope himself had ordered cloistered convents to open their doors to protect Jewish families.
Yes. Actually, the document that you are mentioning was discovered more than 3 years ago. And there was an Italian periodical that published, although not in a complete way, this document that has got its importance, but it's not so revolutionary that as many newspapers have stated in the last days, in the last week. But anyway, during our symposium, other pieces of documents belonging to the so-called private archives of religious families, or, for instance, the Pacelli's families have been proposed during our discussions. And I noticed that I said before that the historians invited by Yad Vashem were very, very attentive to the documents of this kind. For instance, the documents of the religious community. One of the historians invited by the Apostolic Delegation and the Salesian Institution that represented the Vatican Delegation, one of the historians, she proposed a plenty of documents of the religious houses archives.
Now, Father, will this dialogue continue, and what are your hopes for this dialogue in the future?
Yes, the wish that was expressed by everyone who attended the workshop was to go on. And one of the fruits of this meeting that was wished by everyone was to publish all the documents that were mentioned, above all the unpublished documents or the unknown documents that were mentioned. But apart from the publication of the collection of the documents, also the attempt to go on with this kind of partnership. Because, as I said, the atmosphere was very cordial and even friendly.
And a very warm thanks there to the Dean of the Studium Theologicum Salesianum in Jerusalem, Father Roberto Spataro. During this Lenten season, we turn to the Holy Land, where Jesus was born, died, and then rose again. Father Peter Stravinskis, a noted scholar and editor of the Catholic Response, has been accompanying us on a journey of reflection on the places we Christians hold dear as having played an important part in Jesus' life. This week, he takes us on the Holy Family's flight into Egypt. In his Gospel, St. Matthew tells us that not long after Jesus' birth in Bethlehem, King Herod planned a massacre of small boys in an attempt to kill the Christ child. Herod believed that Jesus would grow up to threaten his throne. To escape Herod's deadly plan, Joseph fled to Egypt with Mary and Jesus.
Two things impress me the most about this experience of the Holy Family. First of all, I guess, would be the immediate obedience of Joseph. He's given the care of this woman and child, and in a dream. And it's interesting that the scriptures don't say that this was a vision. The communications with Joseph are in dreams, just as they were with the Joseph of the Old Testament. But he gets this message and immediately, without analyzing this or in any particular way, simply says, this is God's communication to me, and I've got to do this. And in that sense, Joseph becomes a model for all husbands and fathers. In the United States in particular, but probably in all of the developed countries, there's a real crisis of manhood. There's a crisis of fatherhood. Absent fathers, even when they're physically present. And Joseph is a model for Christian men as to what they really ought to be. Strong and loving at the same time. Responsible. Caring. Living up to their own personal vocation. And Joseph gives us, in only the few passages that we find in the New Testament about Joseph, at every turn he emerges as the key figure for Christian men, just as Our Lady is for Christian women. And then secondly, we see how from the very beginning of Christian history, there is a crisis between the Christ event and political authorities. And Jesus, later on in his life, warns the disciples, and us by extension, that we in the world are never going to be on the same page. And so his very presence threatens political power. And the truth of the matter is, if we Christians living in increasingly secularized states don't find ourselves threatened for what we believe and for what we do, it's probably an indication that we're not doing too much. And I used to say, when people say, oh, the church got a good write-up in the New York Times the other day, and I'd say, that makes me very nervous, because I'm quite certain that the New York Times is not becoming more Christian, but perhaps that the church is becoming more secular. Oh! And perhaps just a third thought would be how this mystery in the life of our Lord, his flight into Egypt, shows him once again from the very beginning of his earthly existence to have identified with the marginalized. He has the experience of being a refugee and a migrant. And I don't know if you've seen the Anne Rice book, Christ the Lord, and it's a fanciful account, and she pulls things from various apocryphal gospels and so forth. But interestingly enough, she has him as the child living in Alexandria, where, of course, there was a big Jewish population, and therefore has him also learning Greek. And he enters into that whole experience and is very well rooted in it. The rabbis there think he's the brainchild of their little synagogue school. And then after, you know, a certain point, let's say, I think she gives it about 8 or 10, he's got to be uprooted from that and go back home. And we find so much of that today with, you know, you sit here in Italy where some people live in a house that their relatives had 4 centuries ago. But in most of culture, Western culture, that's not the case. People move constantly, and they're constantly uprooted as a result, not just physically, but therefore psychologically. And so when we say that we are redeemed by the entire mystery of the Incarnation, every aspect of Jesus' earthly life has something to say to our own experience of human life. And the uprootedness of contemporary culture, but most especially those who are literally, physically, migrants and refugees, have in the experience of the Holy Family a model and intercessors on their behalf.
Father Peter Stravinskas is a noted scholar, author, and apologist. He is founder of the Priestly Society of the Venerable Cardinal John Henry Newman and editor of The Catholic Response. As Father Stravinskas mentioned, later works in the New Testament Apocrypha describe a number of miraculous events as happening during the Holy Family's journey to Egypt. Many of these stories are still relived by the Coptic Church, the most important Christian church in Egypt. In these stories, palm trees bowed before the infant Jesus, and the beasts of the desert paid him homage. Today, numerous shrines and churches in Egypt mark the places where the Holy Family is believed to have stayed. And that concludes today's program. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.